ultimately, if people aren't engaged in the overall purpose, the mission, the vision, whatever you want to call it, with the future that the company is headed towards, then you don't have engaged folks.
Picture this. Over half of your workforce is actively looking for new jobs, and only 30% are truly engaged in their work. Today's guest argues that the key to reversing this trend is a leader's ability to shape and elevate a company culture. He co-wrote a wonderful book called The Great Engagement: How CEOs Create Exceptional Cultures. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead of the game. Because we know that great leaders aren't born or made, they are constantly in the making. I'm Damon Lemby, and I'm joined today by my buddy and co-host Darren Bridget, and we're both from Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. In our conversation, we're going to ask Tom to share how leaders can actively turn the tide on low engagement, why aligning employees' personal aspirations with company goals leads to more meaningful work, and the importance of focusing on progress over perfection when building a lasting culture. Tom, it's great to have you, and kind of want to just jump right in. You mentioned that in April of this year, Gallup came out with a new poll, and the poll was that only 30% of employees were engaged, and 52% were actively looking for new jobs. So let's think about that for a second. If you're a CEO or you're a leader and you're out there on a treadmill and you're thinking about this, of a 600 person company, when you walk into the office, 420 people don't really care about what they're doing. I mean, that's kind of nuts, Tom, right?
It is kind of nuts, and it's just sad. And I think as leaders, it's incumbent on us to figure out what do we do about it and not blame others and look in the mirror. I was blessed to give a keynote speech at a conference not too long ago. And when I trotted this out there in front of a room full of people, you could almost hear the sighs in the room, you know, the sort of an acknowledgement of, yeah, that's probably right. And it's tremendously disheartening. The American Psychology Association studied this as well and found out that people take off about 550 million days a year from work-related stress, which costs the economy just in the U.S. alone, $500 billion a year. So we've got a major problem. The good news is there is a path forward, we think, but it takes a lot of conscious effort.
What immediate actions, Tom, can a leader take to understand kind of like what the root cause is that's creating this disengagement?
Well, great question. There's lots of different tools out there. We have our own, we call it the Conscious Culture Survey, which is designed for just that purpose, to get down to what are the root cause, what we call cultural mindsets that exist below the surface that people don't see because they're unconscious, they're below the radar. And so they're meant to unearth those and to really provoke a conversation that allows a team of people to come together and to have really candid, open conversations and start to identify them. And what we found, my business partner's been doing this for over 30 years now with thousands of executives across the country and into Europe, is that there's 12 of these cultural mindsets. And within any organization, there's usually two or three that are the most prominent and the most troublesome, you know, the ones that are causing the most challenge. The beauty is that once you figure out what they are, it's actually quite easy to go to work on those because as leaders, we shape the culture. We are responsible for what we're getting. And so it's tremendously empowering. It doesn't mean it's easy, but it does mean it's possible.
Like in your book, how you say, I mean, I think most of us have heard of that culture eat strategy for breakfast that maybe Peter Drucker said. You actually double down and say culture eats everything. So for you, when it comes to solving these issues of engagement and beating what Damon was talking about, culture is kind of the target in a sense. Like why do you say culture eats everything? Why is it so important?
Well, I mean, you walk into a building, walk into an organization, walk into a school, you can almost taste the culture as soon as you walk in, right? You can spend 10 minutes there and you're like, oh, I think I know what's going on here. And that's why it's so powerful. If you're the CEO of an organization, it's the most powerful tool that you have. And we tend not to think that way. We tend to sort of be, well, the culture is what it is. Well, no, it's not. The culture is what you make it. And so what are you doing to shape your culture, to make it better? There is no there's no there to get to, by the way. It's just, how do we make it better this week than it was last week? And how do we make it better this year than it was last year?
I heard you say that you could walk into a school and within the first 30 seconds, you could kind of get a vibe of what that culture's like, whether it's great, whether it's terrible. I'm just kind of curious, because I, you know, as I mentioned, I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and I'm going to be checking out schools coming up. And so, you know, from a selfish perspective, I want to know what I should be looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you should just trust your intuition is probably my first thought, Damon. It's just when you walk in, if it feels a certain way, there's probably a reason behind that. If it feels sort of stiff and stifling, then you may have a pretty controlling principal who runs a very tight ship. And that's not necessarily bad, but is that what you're looking for? If you walk in, you can feel the energy of the kids, like you said, the vibe, and kids seem to be happy and they're walking down the hall. You know, my kid's school, my daughter is constantly skipping down the hall, my youngest. You know, that says something, right? It says that this is an environment that values the fun of learning. And you look on the walls, you can see different materials. You can see the kids' work. You know, what is that saying to you? Is it been up there for a few weeks or has it been up there for several months? So there's all these quick indicators that tell you a lot about what's going on within the school. And again, it's true of any organization. You could walk into a for-profit engineering firm and pretty quickly get a sense for that culture as well.
So Tom, culture is the key, right? If we can change the culture, but how do you do it? And I think you very much targeted right off the bat this idea of engagement. And I actually love in the book, you got the great resignation and you cross it out and you write in the great engagement. And you want to pivot to like, this is the key thing to think about. You even have this formula, engagement equals action plus empowerment. But if we start with the engagement piece, I found it so fascinating the way you talked about how people do engagement training all the time in organizations, but they kind of do it wrong. They're focusing on things that kind of like, because the engagement doesn't have the right target. The engagement has to be, you said, each person being committed to the purpose of the organization and seeing it as their own aspiration. Like that's the kind of engagement that people need to target, which they're not really doing. How do you do that? Why is that important? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. How much time do you have, Darren?
We got 40 minutes.
We have a pretty intense 5-month engagement that we do with companies to do just that. And so in many ways, it is pretty simple. And in many ways, it's quite difficult. It's quite challenging. It's quite intense, frankly, to really take this work on head on. But at the simplest level, you already said it, engagement, we talk a lot about it, right? There's lots of surveys out there, but we don't slow down and actually think about, well, what do we want people engaged in? We just all assume that we know what that means. And you ask 10 people, you'll get 10 different answers. And our assertion is that ultimately, if people aren't engaged in the overall purpose, the mission, the vision, whatever you want to call it, with the future that the company is headed towards, then you don't have engaged folks, right? And furthermore, engagement that's really profound is when people have their own aspiration. They have their own sense of like, this is what I want out of my life over the next 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. And when they can live out their aspiration within an organization, they can map on their own personal aspiration onto the company's purpose. That's tremendously powerful. And then the second part of the equation is empowerment. When people are empowered with the authority to do their jobs, doesn't mean they're given a blank check, but they're given the appropriate amount of authority and responsibility, then they can go make it happen. You gotta empower your people. Otherwise, you as a leader, you're just a bottleneck or you're a dictator or whatever.
I really like the aspiration piece, Tom, because you hear a lot about empowerment and trust and everything. But aspiration is great. Can you walk us through an example of how you've worked with an organization or a school and seen that transformation?
Yeah, well, I can tell you for myself, Damon, that you know, we're lucky to have quite a few clients across the country, and we're flying from Michigan here to California quite a bit. And there are times when I wake up on a Monday morning and I do not want to get on a plane and fly to California. And I've gotten pretty good, though, where I can pretty quickly remember what's my aspiration in life. Well, my aspiration in life is to serve people, to help be a Sherpa in a way of helping people climb the mountain of life. Because when we do that, it's fun, it's hard, it's exhausting, but we also, every few hundred feet, we get a further perspective, a different perspective. We can see further out from the mountain. And that's pretty awesome. You know, we are growing our capacities, growing our insights, growing as human beings. That animates the heck out of me. It's a tremendous gift to get to do that for a living. You know, people pay us to do this is pretty awesome. And within a few, sometimes seconds, but sometimes minutes, I can remind myself of my aspiration. And then almost like flipping a light switch, I'm not complaining about that airplane ride anymore. I'm excited for it. You know, I'm looking forward to going and helping another organization, a team of people come together in ways that they've never done before. And so that's really an example of how this stuff works, is when we can all slow down enough and get conscious about what's animating our hearts. It's amazing how powerful it can be.
I think, Tom, you talk about the counter to this is where we just naturally live and where we live in an organization. You call it unconscious purpose, and that our unconscious purpose is usually just fear-based, which is a sad thing to think about. But and that organizations kind of get in this vicious cycle of this unconscious, just kind of fear-based purpose. Can you walk us through what you mean by that?
Yeah, and fear is not necessarily a bad thing. I know that it sort of everyone thinks it's immediately bad. But actually, going back to that speech I gave for that conference, I was pretty anxious about it. I don't get anxious about many things. I'm pretty cool, calm, and collected generally. And so I went to my wife and I said, "Hey, babe, I don't know why, but I'm really feeling a little anxious about this keynote speech that I have to give." And she cut me off and she said, "You have to give." And it was really, really good, right? Really, really good coaching for me of like, no, I don't have to give it. I get to. What a privilege, what an honor to do this. And it immediately flipped my switch from fear. Oh my gosh, what are people going to think of me? Am I going to do a good job? Are people going to, you know, like it? Am I going to stumble over my words? You know, that kind of thing up on stage, to no, I get to be of service to the audience. And they're, you know, they're buying our book and that's awesome. And so almost immediately I switched from my fear-based focus on myself to a more agape love, you know, focused on the other, focused on the audience approach of how do I give and how do I be of service to them. And almost immediately the little anxiety started to dissipate. Now the other way that fear is helpful there is that I realized I wasn't ready. Like I really didn't know exactly what I was going to be talking about. So the fear was like, "Hey, Tom, wake up and spend some time getting ready." And so I spent a several hours kind of sitting down, hammering out a structure to my talk. And then boom, like that, again, I was ready to go. I felt much more prepared and the anxiety started to dissipate. So it's not that fear is necessarily bad. The challenge is, especially as leaders, is that we don't often see it. We don't realize that it's driving. There's a great analogy in the healthcare world that, you know, when you wake up in the morning, we are fear-based mostly as humans. We're worried about things. We're worried about how this board meeting is going to go today or how this meeting is going to go today or whatever. And you go out and get in your car and anxiety, this what we call the critic, sort of this negative voice in our head, the imposter syndrome, people call it, is another example, that it's got its hands on the wheel of the car. And our job is to get it out of the driver's seat and into the passenger seat or into the back seat of the car. And some days when we're really in flow and maybe we're really feeling good and we're getting a lot done and we feel like we're on fire, then maybe we've got that critic, that fear in the trunk of the car. But guess what? Next morning you wake up, that fear is right back at the steering wheel, ready to take over. And so the work, a lot of this work is becoming conscious of how are my fears driving me? And in our language, we call it the default success strategy. So as an example, I have a high need for perfection. I like to do things really, really well. I have no qualms about that. I'm quite proud of that, frankly. I like my high need for perfection. But it works great until it doesn't. It works great maybe 90% of the time, but 10% of the time, for instance, in parenting, when I'm overly sort of focused on perfection for my kids, not terribly productive, right, way to parent. And so if I'm able to slow down and realize that, then I can kind of back off. Or if I'm going to do something and it doesn't need to be sort of to my level of perfection, then I'm just wasting time. And so much of folks out there that have a high need for perfection, as an example, are burning out in our society, I think, because they are doing stuff to a level, to a standard that they just don't need to do. They're being driven by their own unconscious desire to make things really, really good. And it's just not necessary in the vast majority of the time.
So, Tom, I think that's a great point you brought up about, you know, the perfection and have it at a certain level. And then going back to your wife, which obviously you got a great partner, right? She comes to you and she's like, oh, you're fearful. You have to give the speech, you know, kind of put you in your place and help you right set your mind, which, by the way, I agree with you. A little fear anxiety is not bad. When I was playing baseball or even coming on podcasts, you always have a little anxiety. I think that keeps you alert and ready to go. Right. You know, I think if you're too much leaning on your heels, then you may not do well. But going back to the perfection or even the fear, is it up to you to keep yourself in check? Or I know that in your book, you talk a lot about being coachable as a leader and having somebody that could, you know, Darren could call me out. Darren's like, hey, Damon, here you go. You're doing this again, right?
Yeah. Yes. There's so much we could talk about there, Damon. So have you guys ever seen those like unconscious bias codexes where they like index all the different unconscious biases that they've figured out so far?
I think we teach that, don't we, Darren?
Yeah. Last time I looked in Wikipedia, there was like 170 of them.
At least, right? At least. I've seen some that have several hundred, right? So good luck is my answer to that. Good luck noticing all of those things. Good luck becoming conscious of all those different things, which means, doesn't mean you shouldn't try, doesn't mean you shouldn't go down that journey. We all should for sure. But having a team around us, in my case, my wife, or if you're working in an organization, if you're the CEO, your executive team is a gifted group of individuals that we don't tap into. And I was guilty of this too when I was a CEO. I was too headstrong and cocky to let them in to help me most of the time. And so we've got this amazing assets right around us that can help us. And so it's one of the reasons, you know, Damon, in our work, we don't really do one-on-one coaching. We almost always engage an executive team starting at the top. Because if you're going to change the culture, if you're going to improve the culture, you have to start at the top. And the CEO or the school superintendent or the nonprofit president, whoever's at the top, has to be 100% committed to it or it won't work. So you engage the executive team of 5, 6, 7 people, and you literally help them to create a coaching culture where we can all just help each other. Doesn't mean that anybody's broken. We're all human. And we don't realize that, you know, there goes Bob and his high need for perfection, or there goes Sarah and her high need for interaction. And to do it in a way that's supportive, that's helpful, not like, oh, there you go again. You know, you're doing your thing again. No, it's just helping people become more conscious.
You have a great analogy about how to be a good coach for somebody. Because I think what the situation you're talking about is where people can like kind of coach each other. Like you open yourself up to coaching, you allow yourself to be coachable, but then you got to be a good coach for each other. And I loved it because Damon, I don't know if you know, but I really liked art history when I was in school, and I always did like a lot of art, still do some, but it was Michelangelo, the way that he would see stone. So he's looking at that big giant block of marble that nobody knew what to do with in Italy in the, you know, 1500s or whatever it was. And he's, because it was cracked, but he saw the shape of the David in it. And so what his job was to just chisel it away so that's all that's left, as opposed to molding something up from clay. And that's how you describe coaching. Like you see the potential that's there instead of trying to mold somebody into something that they're not.
Yeah, exactly. The coach sees the potential. I mean, think about the best teacher you ever had. And that's exactly what they did. They didn't treat you as the little clod of ailments that you showed up as, or the annoying little middle school kid that you were, right? Like we all were. They treated you like the potential that they saw in you. right? They saw something in you, just like Michelangelo saw David in that hunk of granite. The same is true for leaders. We have to elevate people. We have to see more in them than they see in themselves, even that really, really challenging teammate.
I think that that's so wonderful, because our listeners out there, think about that either for yourself or your children. You know, you've had a great teacher growing up who really inspired you and gave you confidence, or a coach you had, or a great leader in the workforce. And Tom, I know one of your taglines that you like to say is that everybody is built with unlimited potential, which I think is so great. And I don't know if this has anything to do with the Elevate System framework. We can talk about that later, or you can mix that in. But how do you go about elevating that, or just pulling that out of individuals? Because I think it's so critical, because a lot of people just don't understand that they have so much more to give, or more confidence to have. They need somebody to help get that out of them.
Well, I like to say that part of our job, a huge part of our job as leaders, is to listen the greatness out of our people. Just listen. It's, you know, 2024, the world is not slowing down. Things are getting more and more hectic, more and more crazy. You know, the number one word that we hear from clients, and this has been true for 30 years, that they're complaining about is communication. You know, communication is a problem around here. Well, the problem with that word is that it means everything, and so it means nothing. But when you really start to dig deeper and start to get to those cultural mindsets I talked about, what's really going on is that we're not listening to each other. You know, we as human beings suck at listening mostly. So much of our work with clients is to just get them to slow down a little bit. And when they do, they're much more effective. They're much more efficient. They waste a lot less time. And so they can actually get more done. It's sort of paradoxical, but it's just a truth that I've noticed in the work that we do.
Damon, I think Stephen Covey said that just the other day, right? That it's, when it comes to people, going slow is fast and going fast is slow. That kind of paradoxical thing. You got another line that I really like, which is coaching doesn't happen when somebody speaks. It happens when someone listens. So that listening goes both ways. It's like if this is going to happen, you have to really work on being coachable too. How do people do that? What's the secret? What's the secret, Tom? Basically, that's the underlying question, Damon, I keep asking here. What's the secret?
What's the secret? Yes. It's the never-ending pursuit of better is the secret, Darren. There is no there to get to. Anybody that says otherwise is delusional, I think, and selling the sort of the American quick fix. But it's just it's an intentional commitment to becoming more conscious. It's an intentional commitment to realizing that, you know, what my daughter said to me or what that colleague said to me, I may not have liked, but if I can slow down and just consider it, not agree with it, just consider it, there's probably value in there. And so that's what we say with coaching. The other key to coaching is that coaching is only coaching if it's asked for. They've done some studies on this. It's fascinating. They actually, who knows how they do this stuff? Brain scientists, they're smarter than me. But they found out that going up to somebody and asking them, are you open to feedback, produces the same response in the brain as hearing footsteps in the dark behind you. Think about that. That's fascinating, right? Like, yeah, footsteps in the
basically
dark
the same
behind
as like
you.
Being bitten by a rattlesnake. Yeah, nobody likes that. Can I give you some feedback? And people always like to say yes.
Exactly. Especially if it's a boss, right? There's only one answer. It's yes. But if you're not ready for it, if you can't take it in, that's completely damaging the relationship. It's destroying trust. Likely, it's a know-it-allism. It's lots of things that aren't helpful. And so, our key is that as leaders, we got to make sure that we ourselves are open to coaching. But then we give people permission to say no. To say no, like they just might not be able to take it today. Like give them a day. Like give them a few days and come back to it. You know, doesn't mean that they get to say no forever. But give them permission to say no, because if they can't say no with integrity, then they can't say yes with integrity. And so coaching is only coaching if it's asked for is a really key foundational element of building a quality team and building a quality culture.
Yeah, I think that's great. And going back to what you said about CEOs needing to be accountable and being responsible for the future and leading by example, meaning that they have to be coachable. Now, when it comes to asking the question, hey, are you open to feedback? Yeah, that's nobody likes that. Do you have a different suggestion on how to approach that then, to give them the opportunity to say no?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You got to start with just some basic ground rules. You got to have the conversation and like create some agreements with folks about like what we're going to agree to, what are we not going to agree to, and just lay some basic foundational elements. Because they gotta trust the setup and you gotta commit to it, you know. So that's critical out of the gate. And then the other is, you know, gets into some of the tools that we talk a lot about in our book, leadership, management, and coaching. These are not new words to anybody, but they are used almost interchangeably in our society nowadays. They're three very, very different tools. It's like saying, hey, can you pass me that saw so I can hammer this nail into the wall? It doesn't work, right? These are three very different tools and you have to know what they're for. So if you want folks to be open to coaching, then one of the most effective ways is to lead more effectively, is to put out a future that people get excited about, that people want to follow. You know, leadership generates voluntary followership. And so lead, get them excited about going somewhere. And you get somebody to commit to, you know, running as sort of a silly example here, but let's say you get somebody to commit to running a marathon. That's going to produce a tremendous amount of desire for them to get help, to get coaching, especially if they've never done it before. It's like, okay, I committed to running the marathon, but I don't know how to do it. So now I got to figure out how to do it. Now I got to ask for help. So that's one way to generate coaching requests. The other is management. You know, get people to make promises, get people to commit to doing things that they commit to, and then they're like, oh geez, I'm excited for this. I want to do that, but I don't know how to do that. I need some help in order to meet that agreement that I made. So that's two overly simplistic examples, but there's thousands of ways to demand, get people to generate a demand for coaching. But those are two of the most simple and most effective ways.
So much of this is it's really just working on your own mindset, how you want to show up as a human being and kind of just doing a good human being job of being a human being. And we all go through a journey of discovery to get there. You were talking a little bit about some of your journey early in your life. And I got excited when you talked about going to Africa, for example, and you were a school teacher for a little while too, or spent a little time, I think, in the classroom. What were those pivotal moments for you that brought you into this kind of mission-driven work that you do?
Yeah, there's been many, and starting with, I was blessed to have amazing parents. You know, they were married for 51 years before my father passed from cancer, and an amazing, loving mother, and two great brothers. And so, I started out at mile 15 of the marathon, and was just by luck and by fortune. So that was certainly a huge part of it, Darren. Is I grew up in a family that was committed to living our faith and being of service to others, not perfectly, but, you know, striving to do so. And then, you know, nothing like a few failures to teach you some lessons, right? I mentioned that I got fired from my job with PricewaterhouseCoopers because a few thousand of us did during the dot-com explosion. And it was really tough for me. I was depressed, frankly, because I didn't really get a chance to prove myself. And here I was without a job. And so I went over to Africa and spent some time with my buddy there. And I started helping them teach. And I just fell in love with it. You know, just fell in love with these kids, even though they had almost nothing for resources. Many of them came to school without shoes on. But there was such a level of contentment and such a level of desire to learn and to grow that they were like sponges. And so it was one of those moments where you're like, I call it a God wink moment, you know, where God's kind of winking at you saying, hey, Tom, wake up. This is what I want you to do. And so I came back from that and started teaching and eventually became a school superintendent and CEO. And so all of that came from a, a really tough period in my life where I got fired. And so it's in those dark moments, I think, where the most blessings can come from it. The first step is to just accept reality as it is, you know, to radically accept things, even if we don't like them, is a tremendously powerful leadership tool. We react to other people like it's a black mamba. We react to their email. We react to a Facebook post or a tweet or whatever at the same level as if we're being attacked and we're about to be killed. And that's what's causing, I think, so much disengagement as in our companies and our organizations, is that we're all on sort of, we're overly hijacked in many ways. And we're not slowing down to say that, okay, Bob didn't copy my email, not because he hates me, he just forgot.
I'm going to remember that, a black mamba moment. Like, you got to watch out for those that are just imaginary. I got to say, I also like Godwink. I've never heard that before. If you say it fast, it sounds like a Dickens character. Godwink. Godwink Hughes. Stepped up to the podium. All right. This is, I have just a couple more questions maybe, but this is a little bit of an odd one. It looks to me like on your shirt, you have the little Augusta National insignia. Is that what that is?
Indeed, yes.
So if you have a perfectionist streak and you've gotten into golf, you must also be tortured.
I do not like the game. That is correct.
Do you play it, or you just like to go to the club?
No, I do play, but it's less and less. As I've had three kids, my interest is more on my kids and less on golf. But I do love playing. I've never been to the Masters. My brother bought me this. He went down and he walked the course for the Masters once and said it was just absolutely astounding and spectacular. I play a handful of times. I like to play. I especially love playing out in Colorado. So wherever it's beautiful, there's sort of a special air to that. We went to Scotland and played with my dad the year before he passed, and talk about Godwink. That was magical. He was not a very good golfer, but he would, you know, he'd duff a shot with his three wood and it would like do this and up and down and it'd disappear. And then we'd go up to the green and it'd be like 2 inches from the hole. You know, it was probably the last round of golf he ever played, actually. So it does have a mystical, magical quality to it. And I have gotten a lot better in the last 2 years in particular, of letting go of sort of needing to be perfect at it, because I never was and never will be, and just trying to enjoy it.
I appreciate that what you said about the perfectionist streak, the some of that you like. And I think honestly, we should acknowledge that, because we ask a lot of that from people that work for us. We're not, a lot of people that are very successful are just super driven because they want things to be so good all the time. It's not necessarily super healthy for everybody, but
not to play with words too much, but We label it having a high need for perfection, which is different than being a perfectionist.
Yeah, yeah.
A perfectionist is a label that is people are stuck with. Having a high need for perfection means that's your need, but it doesn't mean you have to do it all the time. You can choose not to. And that's one of my big gripes with a lot of the four-factor behavioral models out there, is that they're overly complex. They require you to like have a decoder ring. They're not plain English, and they tend to label people and concretize behavior. You know, people say, well, I'm a dot, 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 as if that's built in their DNA. And we like to say, no, I have a high need for something. That doesn't mean that as a leader, especially, I get to be stuck that way. I have to be adaptable. I have to be malleable.
Tom, you have your own model, right? That's kind of similar. I don't want to say similar, but you know, there's 360, there's Myers-Briggs. What's yours?
Yeah, it's called the Elevate system, and it was
there you
designed
go.
I
knew I had that Elevate system in there somewhere.
That's right, coming full
circle. You got
circle.
It in, Damon. You brought it around right to the end. There, good, nice.
Coming full circle. Yeah, we built it as a coaching tool, you know, versus a personality assessment. Even that language is dangerous, I think, you know, because most of these things are 10-minute type quizzes. You can't assess somebody's personality in 10 minutes. We are complex. We human beings are very complicated. Now, having said that, these things are amazingly accurate and extremely provocative. They tend to get all of us thinking, which is the goal, is that you're slowing down and thinking about how do these things show up in my life and how are they showing up in the team dynamic and how do we work better together? You know, all that. When they're used well, they're very powerful. Unfortunately, they're not most of the time. So yeah, it's called the Elevate System. It is a four-factor behavioral model. I was talking to my brother, his best friend's a professor at Wharton, really, really smart guy. And he said that what I've come to realize, Tom, is that all of these models that are out there really boil down to two things. What's your agency? What's the level of agency you want in your life? You know, do you want to take a lot of agency? Do you want to have a lot of sort of authority over your own decisions in life? Or would you rather defer to others, which is an oversimplification, but it's sort of a continuum. And then the other is communion, meaning like, how do I want to relate to other people? And how do I want to interact with other folks? Am I highly interactive and I love thinking out loud with people? Or do I tend to be maybe more introverted in my thinking and I need time by myself? And so when you put that X and Y axis together, agency and communion with others, you can pretty much map any of these models onto it.
Interesting, interesting.
And for folks that are interested, in our book, the Great Engagement, there towards the middle of it, there actually is a link to be able to go and take the Elevate System. So if folks are interested in their own, you know, how they might be showing up, it's a great and fun exploration in self.
And we'll have a link to the book in the show notes for sure. So Tom, as we come up on time here, is there anything else about your book you'd like to share or your work?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think at the end of the day, Damon, it's you only get one life to live, and we've committed ourselves to trying to bring more love into the workplace. And I know that sounds sort of almost dreamlike and idealistic, and it is, frankly. But what we're specifically looking to do is to bring this idea of agape love. Agape is the Greek definition is roughly to put the other first, to be of service to others. And so if you think about that, that's not idealistic. It's actually very, very pragmatic. Any really good organization provides service to others, puts others first, puts the customers first, for instance, and provides something that the customer enjoys. And so when you can do that, not just with your customers, but with your colleagues, it's amazing how a culture can skyrocket to a whole new level of effectiveness. And so fundamentally, if you really think about it, we all wake up with fear, which again is not bad, but if fear is driving us, we're probably not going to make the best decisions. And so we have to muster the courage to switch from that fear to this idea of agape love. You know, what's like the story of me and giving that keynote, right? My wife had me realize that I was focused on me, which is fear. And I needed to focus myself on others and on agape love. And one of the things that we've started to do with a lot of our clients is hand out these coins that say agape love on one side, and on the other side, it says agape love.
That's cool. That's so cool.
When in doubt, flip the coin.
That's great. Good. When in doubt, flip the coin. Well, a lot of takeaways from this conversation for me, Tom. I loved the Black Mamba story and just watching out for those Black Mambas in your brain. The idea that fear, we just default to kind of this unconscious fear that can be in the driver's seat too much of the time. It's not to say that you shouldn't be paying attention and doing the work and fear isn't all bad, but we can unconsciously default to that unless you put some intentional effort into finding that sense of purpose and aspiration. And if you can do that as an individual, but when you do that as a team, as a group, as an organization, it pays like higher orders of benefit, because now you're doing it together, which means you could accomplish better things, and you also can kind of hold each other accountable better. And you do that a lot by having that coaching mindset where you're being a great listener, both in terms of being a coach and receiving coaching. That's part of that story. Those are some of my big takeaways.
Yeah. And I want to add to it that leadership and culture, which is incredibly, incredibly important, starts with the CEO and modeling the behavior. Because, you know, everybody has a culture. It's just going to be determined, you know, where you're at and where you can get it to go. go forward?
It's a lonely job, you know, having been a CEO myself with a couple hundred employees, it is lonely. And so for those CEOs out there listening, you know, find yourself a group, not just a group of local CEOs or local superintendents or local whatever, because those groups can be great. They can be intellectually stimulating, but they tend not to have any depth to them, you know, beyond sort of superficial learning. Find yourself a group where you can actually be more real, more open, and struggle with the things that you're struggling with out loud with others. And it's tremendously helpful. We have a group called The Interchange that's designed just for that purpose. We get together about once a month, and we do an annual retreat in Nashville every year to get together in person. So I'm not saying you need to join that, but for those of you listening, make sure you're finding a group where you can really wrestle with these things, because it is lonely at the top.
And Tom, please send us the link to that so we could add that to the show notes, because I agree with you 100%. And CEOs, like everybody else, they need somebody to talk to, right? Somebody that they can share and be vulnerable with. Where else can our audience and our listeners connect with you at?
Yeah, we'll actually put together a custom landing page that you can put in the show notes that'll have a lot of what I talked about, link to the book, link to what we call the Engaged Life Inventory. For folks who are looking to create a more engaged life for themselves, even if you're not a CEO, we all are the CEOs of our own lives, and to some other helpful resources, The Interchange and whatnot. I'm not terribly active on social media, but I do tend to check LinkedIn pretty frequently. So Thomas Willis on LinkedIn, and our company is Phoenix Performance Partners.
Great. And I want to mention to the audience, it's a great book. If you're interested in culture, which is critical for your organization or for your schools, go get the book, The Great Engagement, How CEOs Create Exceptional Cultures. All right, everybody, do me a favor, hit subscribe, rate and review. And until next time, stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day.